couple of Friday nights ago, Charlene and I were driving along the highway in central Minnesota and saw a new restaurant, actually a diner, and we pulled into the parking lot, went in, and found out it had been open for only 3 weeks. It was 10 o'clock at night. The place was almost completely full, all in a 1950s motif. We were seated at a table, and the waitress came over and brought menus and glasses of water. And she had a bracelet on that had WWJD on it. And Charlene said, "I like your bracelet." And this woman said, "Really?" She said, "I just became a Christian 3 months ago, and it's just fantastic, and my life has been completely transformed." Then she took our beverage order and picked up a tray that she had set on our table with the beverages for the next table. And the round tray had a very large drink, slightly larger than the woman at the table that had ordered it, and it was filled with Coke and with ice cubes, and because it was so heavy, the whole thing tipped over, and the Coke went flying with the ice cubes. I thought it was going to drown this little lady at the next table, and just splattered all over the floor. The waitress first checked the health of her other customer and apologized for what had happened, took their order, walked with the order into the kitchen and left it there, and came out with a mop. She then proceeded to mop up the Coke and to pick up the ice cubes, and I watched her. I watched and listened and saw that she was amazingly joyful in the midst of embarrassment. Everybody in the restaurant was watching her, and in the midst of the menial task of cleanup. And I wanted to say something to her, which I chose not to do because of what had been earlier said. I felt like saying, "What is the matter with you anyway? And why are you so happy under these circumstances?" And it was a question that was asked of Jesus in the story in Luke chapter 5 of his biography. These very religious critics of Jesus watched his followers and said to them, "John's disciples often fast and pray, and so do the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours go on eating and drinking." What they were really asking is, "Jesus, why are your friends so happy-looking when they're supposed to be so religious?" While they never say it, the assumption is that truly religious people are always miserable-looking. Surely you cannot be a Christian and happy at the same time. Those must be mutually exclusive. Now, to understand their question, you have to understand a little bit about who they were. They were deeply committed, very religious men. They called themselves Pharisees. In fact, other people called them Pharisees as well, which meant the separated ones. They were those who had tried to figure out every small part of the law and attempted to keep every small part of the law. Included in that was arduous commitment to fasting and to prayer. Now, it's true that in the Old Testament, the only required fast was in connection with the Jewish high and holy day, the Day of Atonement. But they decided that they would fast every Monday and every Thursday, all day, from sunrise until sunset. They wouldn't eat or drink a thing. They assumed that by doing that, they would draw God's attention to themselves. After all, God has a lot of people to look at, and those that are fasting should sort of differentiate themselves from everybody else. If there was any doubt, they would even wear extra makeup so they would look particularly pale and miserable and get the attention not only of God but of everyone else in addition. Now, to their fasting, they added a daily ritual of prayer. They prayed publicly every day, 7 days a week, at noon, at 3 p.m., and at 6 p.m., again, drawing attention to themselves. At the same time, between their prayers and during their fasting, they observed that Jesus' disciples, they were laughing, and they were eating, and they were drinking, and they were having a great time. And the Pharisees were provoked by this, but also curious. Curious as to how someone could claim to be godly and to be happy at the same time. It is a distinction, by the way, that is of concern to a certain percentage of Americans to this day. I'm sure that if you took an on-the-street survey, you would find that there are a lot of people who assume that if a person is truly religious, if godly, if Christian, then that person should have a dour expression. There should be sadness at the very core of the soul of that individual, and it should be well reflected in public appearance. Jesus' answer to his critics was with analogies, and I kind of like that because I like to think with analogies. He could have been more direct. He could have said, listen, you guys, my followers are happy because it's time to have fun, so they ought to have fun. But he was much less direct. Jesus asked them a question. Can you make the guests of the bridegroom fast while he is with them? Now, again, you need to understand where they're coming from in their culture. They did not take honeymoons. They did not get off by themselves after a wedding. Instead, what they would do is they would have a week-long party, 24 hours a day for 7 consecutive days. And during that time, they would actually have all of the guests and all of the relatives come to the home of the bride and groom. And they would set there 2 chairs that were supposed to be thrones. And they would refer to the groom as king, your majesty, and to the bride as the queen. At least in theory, if not totally in practice, whatever the bride and groom ordered the subjects to do, they were supposed to do. They were royalty for a week. Now keep in mind that these were desperately poor people. The circumstances of their lives were, by our measures of affluence, simply awful. They had few parties and few occasions for true happiness. But this week they were royalty. This week would be the happiest week of their entire lives. This week they would party around the clock for 7 complete days. This week would be the happiest of all. Now Jesus was making a comparison. And he was saying, in this comparison, it's as if I am the groom at this long wedding reception. And he's saying that as long as his followers have him close by, it's time to party and not time to be sad. I try to compare this to the way we do weddings today, and you might imagine a wedding to which you are invited with 4 months' notice. It is a wedding of someone especially close to you, a best friend or a brother or sister, maybe one of your children, if you have adult children that are getting married. And you're really excited about the wedding, and you know just the dress that you want to buy and wear. Unfortunately, that dress comes in a largest size, which is 4 sizes larger than the smallest size that you are likely to be able to fit into. Or maybe you would like to wear an old tuxedo that you have not worn for years because there is no possible way that you could get into that old tuxedo without totally destroying it. And so you decide, I'm going to dye it for 4 months so I can get into the dress or I can get into the tux. So it's one of those lettuce-only diets. So for 16 consecutive weeks, you eat nothing but lettuce. You start to look like a rabbit. Your nose sort of wobbles up and down when you talk to people. You sort of turn slightly green in your color. And the day of the wedding comes. It's fabulous. You're filled with happiness. You get into the dress. You get into the tux. You go to the reception. You're seated at the head table right by the bride and groom. And there's one of those little menu cards that's provided. And it explains that you will start out with jumbo shrimp cocktail. That you will then have lettuce, a salad, that is served with extra fat dressing. It's a specialty of the house. And then you're going to have prime rib, loaded with juice and surrounded with buttered vegetables. And on the side, you are going to have high-calorie rolls that are pre-buttered to save you the inconvenience of having to do it yourself. And then you will follow all of that with large-sized servings of cheesecake. And what are you going to do? Are you going to ask for a naked piece of lettuce on a plate because that's your diet? Of course not. You know exactly what you're going to do. You're going to say, hang the diet. I'm going to eat it all. This is the day, not for diet, but this is the day for celebration. This is the day to fully enjoy all that's provided together with my very closest of friends or relatives. This is the day of celebration. Now, Jesus was saying that it's the same when he's around. When you're around Jesus, it's not the time. It's not the time to be sad. It's not the time to be strict. It's not the time to avoid the happiness of life. It's the time to celebrate. Although he did indicate that sad days were coming. He told them that the time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them, and in those days they will fast. He was not referring to now. He was referring to something which he hinted about increasingly until, as it got closer, he made full declaration that he was going to be crucified. And he looked forward to that time when on a Friday he would die on a cross and sadness would fill the hearts and the lives of his followers. And between the afternoon of Friday and the morning of Easter Sunday, they would probably not eat a morsel. It would be a time of grief and agony. But then that too would pass. And the resurrection would replace once again the happiness in the presence of Jesus Christ. Now let's be very sure that we get Jesus' total meaning here. He is not suggesting that we do not take Christianity seriously. He doesn't mean that Christians never cry. He is not negating the importance of repentance from sin and doing that which is right. But Jesus is teaching that repentance and faith in following him does not lead to desperation and sadness, but leads to fullness and leads to joy. And the reason that Christians have joy is not primarily rooted in the circumstances of life that we cannot control. The reason that Christians have joy is because of a relationship with Jesus Christ himself. So it is not party for party's sake. Rather, it is joy because of a close personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Are you then saying that Christians do not have problems? Is this claiming that we do not suffer pain or that sometimes life may not be very, very hard? Well, of course we have problems. And of course there is pain. And of course there are days, if not months and years, when life is very, very hard. But it is to say that with Jesus there is a joy that is greater than the worst problems that we will ever encounter. And so Jesus invites even his skeptics to make a trade, to switch away from the old and to claim that which is new. And he does it with a parable, actually a two-part parable. He says, "No one tears a patch from a garment and sews it on to an old one. If he does, he will have torn the new garment, and the patch from the new will not match the old. And no one pours new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the new wine will burst the skins. The wine will run out, and the wineskins will be ruined. No, new wine must be poured into new wineskins." And then he adds a P.S., sort of an epilogue. And he says, "And no one after drinking old wine wants the new, for he says, the old is better." And the contrast here is between an old way of living and a new way of living. The old way depending upon ourselves and stuck with sin and with lots of sadness. And the new way is totally depending upon Jesus Christ. And sin is forgiven. And there's a great deal of joy. Jesus' point is that the old way and the new way do not mix very well. Although there are a lot of people that try to do that. There are people who say, you know, I kind of like my life the way it is. But you know, Christianity's got something to offer as well. So let me just take a 17% bite of Christianity and sort of add that to the rest of my life. But Jesus is saying, no, don't do it that way. Do it the revolutionary way. Not the 17% way, but the 100% way. I think if he were using today's terms, he would put it like this. Imagine that you go to an expensive department store, and you buy the most costly pair of designer jeans. I mean, really expensive. Fit wonderfully well. You look fabulous in. And you bring them home, and you lay them out on the bed, and you just look at them. And then you go into the closet, and you pull out an old pair of jeans that you got on a blue light special, 50% off blue light. And they are just tattered. And especially embarrassing is a very large hole in the seat. And you put that on the bed next to the expensive new designer jeans. Then you go to the kitchen and you get some very sharp scissors. And you come and you cut a hole out of the seat of the new designer jeans and leave a big gap there. And then you sew that onto the beat up old tattered jeans so that you can cover the hole that is on the back of them. You say, that's crazy. Absolutely crazy. Why would anybody do that? Because in the first place, you'd ruin the expensive designer jeans. In the second place, it wouldn't ever match. It wouldn't look very good at all, even on the old ones. It just doesn't make any sense at all. And Jesus says it's the same way with life. That Christianity is the newest and the best. And when there is a hole in life, it is not the smart thing to just cut a patch out of Christianity and then sew it on to the place where the hole exists in life. That there ought to be a complete change of clothes. That it's intended to be something completely new. Now, for those that don't get that analogy, he offers a second analogy. And that's about wine. In those days, they didn't have plastic containers and glass bottles as we do today. And they would store liquids in animal skins. So they would take, for example, the skin of a goat. They would take all the hair off it. They would sew it up. And then they would pour water or wine into that very flexible, but if it was sewn correctly, not leaking wine skin or water skin. Now, it worked great. You could use it to store wine or water at home. You could take it on a trip like we take thermos bottles today. It was really a convenient way of doing what they needed to do. However, over a period of time, the skin would become brittle. So that you had to be very careful with its inflexibility. And one thing you didn't want to do was when you emptied the old skin of the wine, you drank the wine or you poured it out, you don't want to put new wine into an old wine skin. Because when the new wine ferments, it bubbles and it expands. And that will rip open this brittle old skin. What you need is a new skin for the new wine. In this case, Jesus is saying, don't try to pour a little bit of God into an old life because God is expansive. God is bubbly. God will break open an old life. What you want to do is abandon an old life and take on a terrific new life in Jesus Christ that is flexible, that will contain all the newness that God has to offer. Jesus is saying, dump the old life and become a 100% new person in Jesus Christ. That every section of life, every relationship, every possession, all the things that we have and are, it's a 100% deal with Jesus Christ. Then Jesus does something that he typically does when we read throughout his biography. He anticipates the next thing that the people are going to say. He anticipates that someone is going to say, yeah, but I like the old stuff. I like the old wine, and I like my old way of living. So why should I try the new? And so he finishes his story saying, no one after drinking old wine wants the new, for he says the old is better. So this refers to the person who is sitting at a cafe table, a restaurant in Jerusalem, and somebody says, oh, you have this great new wine, you're just going to love it. And he says, nah, I'm not into new stuff. Let me just try the old stuff. And then drinks until he wants no more, and the person says, come on, at least taste it. He says, no, I don't want any more now. The old is better. And as a result, he totally misses out on that which is new and good. I grew up in the part of the East where there are lots and lots, millions of Italian immigrants and their descendants. And one of the very good consequences of that is lots of marvelous Italian restaurants. So when I was a grade schooler, my parents often took our family to this elite place called Joe's Pizzeria on Bloomfield Avenue. And it was renowned in that area for having really good pizza. But I didn't like pizza. I'd never had it, but I didn't like it. And I was kind of a fussy eater as a child. I didn't eat any vegetables until our 10th wedding anniversary, so I was sort of so the whole thing was sort of a slow go. And my argument, which I remember well, and does have a certain reasonableness to it, was just look at a pizza, and you could tell it's not supposed to be eaten. I mean, it's really a disgusting-looking thing if you think about it for very long. So we would go to Joe's Pizzeria, and I would refuse to eat the pizza. And they would threaten me and bribe me and say terrible things were going to happen to me and all this. But it didn't work. I was pretty stubborn about the whole thing. And a waiter one day, noticing that I wasn't eating and asking why, suggested an alternative that wasn't on the menu. He said that they had ground beef back in the kitchen that they could shape into a hamburger patty, and they could cook a hamburger for me, and they would serve it in an Italian roll. And I said, I prefer a hamburger bun. You know the whole how the deal goes. Fearing that my family would disown me, I finally agreed to a hamburger in an Italian roll and ate that while the rest of the family ate the pizza. And I learned a lesson with these visits, and that is if you get the hamburger first and you eat it completely, and then there's pizza left over at the end, and when your family starts saying these humiliating things, just take one little bite. Here's an airplane. One little bite. That you could say, no, I'm really full from the hamburger, see? And that would always get you off the hook. And I would never have to try what was new. Now, you know that this is not about pizza, and you know this is not about wine. This is about life. And you know that what Jesus is here saying is that there are many of us who become so comfortable in our old ways of life that we have established exclusive of Him, that when we are given the opportunity for a freshness and a fullness and a dazzling new taste that's wonderful of Jesus Christ and all He has to offer, what we say is, no, the old stuff is good. I don't try new things. And that is a tragic loss. Because it means that we, instead of living 100% with Jesus Christ, never taste Him at all. C.S. Lewis, the famous English writer, the author of the Chronicles of Narnia, the man who, if I recall correctly, died on the same day that John Kennedy was assassinated. C.S. Lewis, in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, tells his resistance to becoming a Christian, how he had intellectual doubts and arguments and emotional reticence, all the things he avoided. And then finally, one day, he decided, all right, I'm going to do it. But he said, even then, he was like someone stiffly standing before a cold mountain stream, reluctant to jump in and fearing the cold feeling that he would experience, only to do it and to find out it's delightful. Delightful to become a Christian. Now, if you are a Christian today, I invite you to fully enjoy all that that means, to discover the joy of Jesus Christ that transcends even the most difficult of circumstances that otherwise would tear our lives apart. I encourage you to be a Christian 100%, that you do not just patch life with Jesus, but that all of life belongs to Him. And if you are not a Christian this morning, that you do not simply sew Him onto the hole that is currently causing you trouble, but that you give to Him all of the rest of your life, that you leave behind the old and embrace the new, decide to become a 100% Christian. Giving up sin and following Jesus as the leader of life. Now that decision, whether it is for those who have already committed themselves to Jesus Christ or those who for the first time do it, is in both cases a matter of faith. And faith is that mental, that emotional, that total volitional commitment, 100% to Jesus Christ. And you know, the instant that there is faith, God knows. It's astonishing. He knows. We don't have to say a word. He knows when we fully believe and commit. But for most of us, it is a helpful thing to have a prayer to cement the commitment that we have made. And so I offer to us this morning that opportunity. I ask you to pray with me, or actually to pray privately and personally, to talk to God and to tell God that you want this new life with Jesus Christ. Tell Him that you're ready to quit sinful old ways and to embrace everything new in Jesus. Tell Him that you don't want a patch job, that you want everything new, 100% Jesus.